Well, to start off, Anne, if you can cast your minds back to ancient times, it seems that when people started to think about how to think of the world as comprising of different substances and how to distinguish between different substances, it seems that this distinction between homogeneity and heterogeneity was crucial to the issue. So that if you picked upon an arbitrary quantity of matter, it was in all likelihood heterogeneous, but if you fixed on certain portions of it, then you'd come across a homogeneous part. So here we have the air, here we have the water, and here is earth, and so forth. And where you have a quantity of just separated, then you develop notions of same substance. You can fiddle about this, then you can arrive at ideas about what suitable properties are in terms of which to characterize substances. Nowadays, this is not accepted. Today, we think that homogeneous quantity of matter might well comprise several substances. Solutions, for example, so that we could be seen as comprising several substances, or the air as a mixture of several substances. And also, we recognise that a heterogeneous quantity of matter might comprise a single substance. I suppose in water it would be a sort of heterogeneous mixture, but nevertheless, a single substance. So the idea of in virtue of what, or the criterion by which a given quantity of matter is determined to be to comprise a single substance, is no longer quite so easily discernible as it was once thought to be. And this is going to be the topic of. Major topic, my major theme, the virtue of what a quantity of matter is thought to comprise a single substance. Now, I'm going to talk a lot about water, and I'll start off by saying a few things about the background to the chemical discussion of water. As you know, water was once thought to be an element, but then it was analysed and discovered to be a compound. Think of Lavoisier, who, after Cavendish had discovered that by burning hydrogen you can create water, then he analysed water by reducing steam over heated charcoal, and it gave us an analysis of the composition of water, the proportions of hydrogen and oxygen in water. Now, Lavoisier is important because he established two fundamental principles on the indestructibility of matter and the idea of constant proportions. I sometimes said that the constant proportions is something which came late at the beginning of the 19th century, but that was a case of Proust responding to Berthelot, who was challenging the notion. And so at the beginning, I don't think a definite date is given to this, because it was eventually thought that Proust had established that compounds do comprise constant compositions. Of course, 100 years later, it was then realised that there was something to what Berthelot was saying, but I'm not going to talk about Berthelides in this discussion. Going back to the indestructibility of matter. So the idea is that in a chemical reaction, although we say that the reactants, some substances disappear and new substances appear, according to Lavoisier's way of looking at this, this is not a matter of the creation and destruction of matter, but one of the same quantity of matter ceases to be certain substance and becomes another substance. So I think of water then as a property which is possessed by a quantity of matter pi for a given time, and at other times it might well be that this quantity pi is not water. the notion of constant proportions leads to this idea of the compositional formula. A compositional formula gives us the proportions of the elements in the compound. But the way in which chemistry is they rescale the gravimetric proportions in terms of equivalence, so that you can think of the idea of gravimetric proportions is that you can compare the weight of a given quantity with respect to a sample in the gravitational field. It's a question of how this balances against the force of gravity against your standard compound. The idea of equivalence is that you're thinking about how one substance combines with another substance, and so it's a combining power with respect to some standard substance that the equivalence measure. So if we compare the analogous compounds, hydrogen sulfide and water, then although the gravimetric proportions are different, the gravimetric proportions of hydrogen to oxygen in water are 1 to 8, whereas in hydrogen sulfide the proportions are 1 to 16 of hydrogen sulfide. Nevertheless, we want to say that there's as much oxygen in water as there is sulfur in hydrogen sulfide, or as much hydrogen in the two compounds, and this is a way of saying that. It's a question of rescaling the proportions. The actual figures are not going to be going to this, but the two in the H2O of water arose historically as a matter of considering how substances react with one another. So that Williamson determined that you can describe relations between alcohols and ethers, but by determining them to be on the water type was a type theory, and this is understood in terms of alcohols derived from water by replacing one equivalent of hydrogen in water by one equivalent of alcohol, whereas ethers are derived from water by replacing each of two equivalents of hydrogen by either the same or different equivalents of alkyl groups. In the case of complicated substances like alcohols and ethers, this led to notions of structural formulae in virtue of which isomers can be distinguished. But in the case of water, there are no isomers. So there's only one compound which has the composition of water, the elements of proportions that water has, so that not only is water H2O, but H2O is water. So we can say that all quantities of water, given time, if and only if they're H2O. I just want to mention that point out here that if you're understanding compounds in terms of composition, then this already implies that the notion of a substance is independent of phase, so that steam and ice are H2O, and so water, according to the compositional idea. So this old Aristotelian idea, on which homogeneity, heterogeneity ideas and so on are applicable, because your notion of substance is not out of phase. And if you talk about composition of water, you can't say that water is composed of hydrogen and nitrogen gas. You often talk about some hydrogen as hydrogen gas, and that's a natural expression. There's no in liquid water at normal temperature and pressure, there's no gas there. Well, that's the importance of water as H2O, and so far there's no mention of microstructure. Now I want to go on to talk about the micro world, and I'm going to do this by contrasting water, which is complex. Water is a complicated thing with a simpler case. So I'll talk about this simpler case first. There is this simple idea which has its applications. Thinking now on the micro scale, that a quantity of matter comprises a single substance if it's composed of particles which are all of the same kind. And if we're talking in particular about compounds, then we call these particles molecules. Now, what's a molecule? Well, I've given this quotation from Maxwell here, just to convey the idea. A molecule may be defined as a small mass of matter, the parts of which do not part company during the excursions which the molecule makes when the body to which it belongs is hot. The idea here is that you make a distinction between the intramolecular forces, the bonding of the parts which keep the molecule together, and the intermolecular forces to which all molecules are subjected, but whose influence that doesn't affect the integrity of the molecule. So that when you think about going from a solid phase to the liquid phase, and you think that it's these intermolecular forces loosen up, and then when you go to liquid gas, and they loosen up even more. But the molecules are preserved, so the molecule is something which has a longevity. it survives all of these transitions. Now this idea, if you're a chemist, this comes from organic chemistry, and many organic substances are what I'm going to call molecular substances. They comply with this idea. And I'm going to pick up methane as my typical example of a molecular substance, but there are others. Now, water is a classic case of a non-molecular substance. I just want to develop this a little. The first indications of this are that if you make a comparison with methane, so the methane is approximately the same molecular weight, so it's a reasonable comparison. And you see that methane has a boiling point way down around about minus 180 and boils at about minus 160. Whereas water is obviously very different from that. So there's something going on in water which is at the heart of this and many other differences. Now, I'm going to go into a little more detail about this. But first, there's a very important point that we should all realise that the established status of water in science. Well, several years ago, I think it would be a sensation if it wasn't still the case, because it's a mystery. That's what chemists say about water. Water is it really is mysterious. And I've got a quotation here, it's a very nice way of summarising this. This is a quotation from Franks, who edited a whole series of enormous volumes in the middle of the 70s, also the early 70s. Which are lots of clever, very clever people from all sorts of fields brought together a lot of studies on the nature of water. And Franks writes his introduction to all these volumes, and there he says that water is probably the most studied, but least understood substance. Franks wrote a book 20 or 30 years later on water and finds similar comments. And it's been some years now since I've talked to people about this, but my experience of this was that you speak to physical chemists who tried to say something about water, and often gave up in frustration. The problem is, if you're really trying to approach water from the microscope point of view, then you want to be able to at least calculate the thermodynamic properties, at least within a sort of reasonable margin there. And apparently this is hopeless. I mean, they're only not looking about 5% error. I mean, that's sort of 120% off. It really is difficult. So I think we should, this is a very important point, that our water is mysterious. This doesn't seem to have prevented philosophers pontificating about the nature of water, but I don't know what the joy is in making these sort of claims about the structure of water, but I leave that aside. So quantitatively at least, what is a problem, and even qualitatively, there are lots of things to worry about. But you can say something about water in very broad terms. Now, I don't want to try to make too much of a meal of this, but Well, the high melting point of water, as you go from the solid to the liquid phase, suggests that the liquid will stick together. So that it's very difficult to loosen up the structure of ice, so that you go over to the liquid phase. But then the latent heat, the fusion of water, the amount of heating required to at the melting point, converted from solid to liquid, it is only 15% of the latent heat required to get the water from the liquid into the gas phase. Now, I mean, comparisons with other substances suggest that this is a very large difference, and it suggests that this loosening up of the structure of ice to get your liquid is nevertheless such that a lot of the structure remains, and so you need to put in a lot of energy to actually reduce it. And so that when you go into the gas phase, then at least the temperatures below, say 500 C, and it starts to decompose. So the water in the gas phase is molecular. But you've got to put in a lot of energy to do that. Well, it seems that so a lot of this structure remains. So this is understood in terms of polymer structures in which the water molecules are held together by lots of water hydrogen bonding. Now this is a dynamic situation. It seems that the structures are changing all the while, so that the bonding breaks and then is reforming again all the while. But on average, this relatively rigid structure is there. It makes a mystery of where the fluidity of water comes from. But the issue here is from what I said about Maxwell a couple of slides ago. Well, should we count this hydrogen bonding, which holds the water molecules together in these polymer structures, should we just call this molecular forces? So not count these large structures as the particles which are in water. Well, this is a very complicated issue. In the days when people started to talk about hydrogen bonding, so in the 20s and 30s, they said that hydrogen has a valency of 1, so it's used up in bonding with the oxygen, so there's anything else, any connection by hydrogen attracts nearby molecules, so that must be some sort of electrostatic intermolecular reaction. But since then, it's quite apparent that hydrogen bonding is very complicated and not quite easily treated in this manner. And the distinction between intermolecular bonding and hydrogen bonding is not easy to make. I'll just say that in a recent discussion of the topic of hydrogen bonding, there's a report by the EUPCA where they try to arrive at a way of, call it a definition, a way of characterising what is and what isn't a hydrogen bond. They fix on this as a very important criterion, the notion of directedness, that the bonding is directed. It's not like the thing you're getting out of crystal structure where you just talk about the packing that supposedly is possible. This directedness seems to be taken as a criterion that what you're talking about is something which should be called bonding and not merely interaction. And you can go on to make other comparisons. You talk about proteins and the second structure of protein, which you lose if you denature them, say, subject them to extreme pH. You preserve this polypeptide structure, which is the kind of structure you need to distinguish isomers in classic organic chemistry. But once you lose this secondary structure, which is held in place by hydrogen bonding, then you lose all of the interesting chemical properties of proteins. And traditionally, the chemical reactivity of a substance is thought of as one of its characteristic properties. So perhaps you should think of denatured proteins as a different kind of substance from the ordinary occurrence. Anyway, so it seems that there are arguments counting the sort of particles in bottom waters, these very long polymetric species of continually changing in structure. You might want to say that there is nevertheless, as it were, a common factor, thinking of some sort of numerical analogy, that these H2 molecules, which are a factor, are a common factor throughout all of these polymetric species. But you can't really maintain that because there's a dissociation. So hydrogen ions and hydroxyl ions are produced as the result of dissociation of the water. Now, this, I don't know if you feel this with me, but the concentrations of these ions are exceedingly low. And that might be taken as grounds for not taking it seriously. But the important point is that this is a dynamic situation. So there's continual combination and recombination, which maintains concentrations over time. So this process is very fast. So if you're talking about times as long as, I say, half a second, you're in the macroscopic scale of time, then something like half of any given quantity of water will have gone through this process. These units are not things which are, as it were, preserved over time. Well, so the question arises, why is water regarded as a single substance? If on the grounds of what, on the basis of what I've said, then a quantity pi, which is water for some given macroscopic time, can't be monologically partitioned into H2O molecules. It raises the question of why, by what criterion we regard a given quantity of water as a single substance. So I'm suggesting that we can turn to macroscopic theory, the thermodynamics, as a way of providing an answer to this. I'm going to have to do this fairly quickly. The point about thermodynamics is that it divides the mass, unlike mechanics, it divides the mass into amounts of different substances. And so you'd expect that the theory will generate some sort of results which are which lend themselves to the solution of this issue. Well, there's this thing called the phase rule, which says that there's something called the variance, which is given by C, the number of substances, less F, the number of phases, plus 2, and all of that is greater than 0. Well, I'm going to talk about an example soon, so we'll talk about the variance then. But you can see that from this, if we're talking about single substance, C is equal to 1, and that means that F is less than 3. But not less than 0, it's between. Maybe you can't have minus 10 phases. Well, if we go to the case where F is 2, you've got a situation here in which you've got a quantity of material in a closed space which exhibits a liquid and a gas phase, and it's enclosed by this movable piston at the top. Well, according to the phase rule, it should have a variance of 1. It follows from the phase rule. 1 substance, 2 phases. And the variance is the number of independent variables which determine the state of the substance. So with the variance of 1, if we think that what's important here is the temperature and pressure, well, if we fix the temperature, so we're looking at this at a fixed temperature, then the pressure is fixed. It can't vary independently of temperature. So if you try to change the pressure, for example, by plunging the piston, then let it go back to equilibrium. Then you won't, as long as you've got 2 phases, you won't succeed because the matter will go from the gas phase into the liquid phase. And similarly, if you try to reduce the pressure, then the material moves from the liquid phase into the gas phase. If you continually raise the piston, I mean, assuming the apparatus is geared up for this, then all will be gas. But then you've only got 1 phase. So then the variance is 2. So it means that the pressure and the temperature, for example, can vary independently. But the variance is fixed at 2, so as I said, the volume then can't vary independently of the temperature and pressure. So I mean, this is what's also expressed by the familiar gas law. And then in the other case where F is 3, then this corresponds to a variance of 0. So so that there's a very specific temperature and pressure which water can exhibit 3 phases, which is so-called triple points of water. It's a universal state of matter that determines that temperature. So this is another one. Was used to calibrate the absolute scale. It's a point above 0. So, just a couple of final words. I'm trying to say why I think this notion, at least in certain cases, that this notion of substance is a macroscopic concept. It's the macroscopic criteria which I'm going to tell you that you're dealing with a single substance. So I've talked about two kinds of substances, molecular and non-molecular substances, which I've been working on this treatment. I'm not claiming to have said the last word on the notion of substance. There are all sorts of strange cases which you might consider in one way or another. I'll just draw your attention to the restrictions on my treatment, include the restrictions that I'm talking about equilibrium. I'm not considering mixtures, I'm just considering isolated substances, and I considered longish times, I consider that small times, which is connected to the notion of equilibrium, of course. And I mean, something I think is interesting to do then is to perhaps consider how you deal with the notion of substance, like, or how you think of these quantities, especially as a very large structure, under conditions where when these conditions are relaxed, and it seems to me to be an interesting way in which to pursue this discussion. Okay, thank you.